Duane Demke loved the ocean and scuba diving far more than most people. Diving was his passion, and he would do whatever it took to ensure that he would be able to dive in the most beautiful waters in the world. He grew up in North Battleford and Saskatoon before moving to Edmonton, Alberta, where he often worked several jobs, but ones that allowed him to have the freedom to travel and pursue his passion. Throughout the years, Duane indulged his wanderlust, spending months exploring the world while sharing his expertise as a scuba instructor or an assistant instructor at renowned diving sites. Despite the dangers associated with the sport, Duane approached each dive with a calculated understanding of the risks. He navigated encounters with ocean predators with confidence. Little did he know, his ultimate fate wouldn't be sealed by the creatures of the sea or equipment error, but rather by a very unexpected threat on land. This is Twisted Travel and True Crime, and I'm Sandy. This case, it's a wild one with some very interesting twists and turns. We crossed the borders between the U.S. and Canada more than once, but let's begin with Duane Demke's last night alive. Duane was a fun, loving guy. He laughed at everything, was kind-hearted and thoughtful. He was a hard worker and went out of his way for people he cared about. And that's what he was doing on the evening of May 30th, 2015. On the eve of what would become his final day on Earth, Duane Demke found himself immersed in the glow of his computer screen. He was excitedly planning an upcoming trip to Disney World. As the sun began to set, he dressed himself in a crisply pressed shirt and tie, as he was planning to go to a birthday party to honor one of his closest friends, Kailia, one he had a crush on. Later, Kailia would show the jury a picture of herself and Duane that night, with smiles plastered to their faces. She solemnly told them that Duane was more than a friend. He was family. The two of them communicated nearly every day. He came over to her house once a week for dinner, and they went out to restaurants, shopping, and even took vacations together. She held her tears back as she spoke of Duane. After the birthday dinner, he left her to go to work as a driver for a party bus that had been rented to drive a bachelor party around the city. The men who had partied the night away said there was nothing out of the ordinary about Duane. They described him as reserved and quiet. The most memorable thing was that without anyone in the group making a request, Duane arranged to have an exotic dancer on the bus with them. The best man said the dancer was a surprise and that the family of the bachelor had been a bit upset about having a female entertainer on the bus because the soon-to-be bride had very strict regulations. Regardless, the dancer stayed and would later confirm that she got a last-minute request from Duane to work the bus. But no one on the bus had seemed upset by anything that happened that evening. In fact, everyone had a great time. She hadn't noticed anything strange about Duane either. He'd been easygoing and friendly. She'd never seen him in a bad mood. When the party ended, he drove her back to her vehicle around 2 a.m., and she helped him straighten up the bus before giving him a hug and telling him goodbye. After that, he drove the bus back to the garage to give it a final cleaning. Between 2:48 and 2:55 a.m. on May 31st, Duane exchanged text messages with his roommate, Brian. He sent photos he had taken of the exotic dancer on board the bus. Those would be the last messages he would ever send. The 31st dawned bright and clear that Sunday morning in Calgary. A pedestrian who had been enjoying a peaceful walk was passing by a parking garage when he heard a loud explosion. Thinking quickly, he pulled out his smartphone, pointing it toward where the noise had come from, and recorded a video showing a man running away from the garage. The man was looking back over his shoulder. Intrigued, the walker moved toward where he'd heard the noise and found a smoldering Acura sedan inside the garage. He quickly called for help. Firefighters and police soon arrived and were relieved to find no one inside the car, but they were puzzled as to why it had been set on fire. It had indeed been set on fire. But the person who lit it up wasn't very smart. He had lit the fire in the trunk and then closed the trunk's lid, which effectively put out the fire. This mistake preserved the interior of the car, which was what the arsonist likely wanted to cover up. The inside of the car was covered in blood, too much to be from a minor cut, and enough to make the police worry that something really bad had happened inside that vehicle. The owner of the car was Duane Demke, who lived 3 hours away from where the car was found. Dwayne's brother Darren received a call from the Calgary Police arson investigator, who informed him about the incident. Despite the insinuation that Dwayne might have been involved, Darren was certain his brother had nothing to do with it. Word spread quickly, and concern grew as family and friends couldn't reach Dwayne. He hadn't gone home that night. His roommate had begun to worry that something was wrong when he received a phone call shortly before noon the next day from Dwayne's dad. He had called to ask Dwayne's roommate to knock on his door and wake him up because his car had been stolen and was on fire in Calgary. Dwayne's bed was still made and hadn't looked like it had been slept in. His roommate didn't know what to do and felt helpless. He wasn't alone in those feelings. Dwayne's friends and family had no idea what happened to him. There were phone calls, text messages, and Facebook posts as his loved ones scrambled to figure out what was going on. Darren Boisvert had known Dwayne for 13 years. The two men weren't close friends, but kept in touch regularly through social media. When a cousin let Darren know that Dwayne had disappeared, he followed his instincts. Darren searched for the address of the company where Dwayne worked and found it wasn't very far from his own, prompting him to drive out there out of curiosity. He wanted to know what the place looked like and what the parking lot looked like. Upon arriving at Revolution Limousine, he began photographing the scene with his cell phone, taking precautions by capturing various angles before touching anything, anticipating a worst-case scenario. As he ventured to the back, where the limo bay and parking lot were situated, Darren noticed two unusual items sitting inside a planter. These items were a North Face hat and what appeared to be a large knife sheath. They struck him as having been recently placed there, considering they weren't very dirty, despite recent rainfall. Initially, he didn't consider contacting the police, as he was still in the early stages of learning about the situation, but he carefully handled the evidence, later emphasizing that he never touched the items directly and had used work gloves to pick the items up and place them in a plastic shopping bag. He then attempted to take the items he found to the police. The office he went to was closed, so he made a phone call and left a message. The next day, the police came to gather the evidence and to question Darren. He didn't know at the time that he had gathered evidence that would eventually put a killer in jail. Kylia, much like Darren, decided to lend a hand too, but instead of working solo, she rallied a team of friends. Together, they embarked on their own investigation, gathering flyers, putting up billboards, and reaching out to Dwayne's contacts, piecing together information to understand the situation better. They too visited the limo company's location, hoping to find clues or surveillance footage. Using Dwayne's iPad, they tracked his phone's last location. What they found indicated that it might have been discarded along a highway. They searched the area, determined to find any trace of Dwayne, but they found nothing. Although the police were treating it as a missing persons case initially, after 4 days and no sign of Dwayne anywhere, they recognized the severity of the situation and called in homicide detectives. Despite the lack of forensic evidence of Dwayne's demise, they approached the investigation as a potential murder case. They started again from scratch. Detectives sifted through a chaotic mix of items uncovered by the missing persons team. Inside the car, they found documents bearing different names, including one belonging to Angel Shalafu. Curious, they reached out to Angel for insights. Angel, as it turned out, shared a significant history with Dwayne. They had lived together for 8 years. Despite ending their romantic relationship, they remained close friends, speaking daily and meeting frequently. Angel hinted at a possible motive involving her ex-boyfriend, Robert Aubrey Maxwell, who had harbored resentment towards Dwayne due to their close bond. According to Angel, Dwayne had warned her about Robert. Dwayne thought he wasn't right for her and urged her to sever ties with him. Robert didn't like all the time that Angel made for Dwayne. Jealousy and insecurity fueled a breakup. When Angel was asked what Robert typically wore, she unknowingly described a North Face hat. It matched the one found near Revolution Limousine. This made the detective's eyebrows raise. If that hat belonged to Robert, it could directly link him to Dwayne's disappearance. they sent it in to be DNA tested. As the investigation pressed on, Angel was brought in for further questioning. Although there was footage outside the garage from where Duane disappeared, the quality was poor. There was what looked like a man captured on film, but the grainy footage made the exact identification impossible. Even so, Angel said she thought there was a very good chance that the man captured on film was her ex, Robert. The problem was that Robert had vanished. They went to his home only to find it abandoned. They were able to get a search warrant, and what they found inside was pretty interesting. They found a machete that matched the same brand as the knife sheath found in the planter at the limo service. The knife sheath left behind at Revolution Limo was identified as a Gerber Jr., while the knife discovered in his apartment suite was a Gerber Sr. Essentially, the one in the apartment was the same knife, just significantly larger. The Jr. version wasn't small. It measured 12 inches in length, with a fine edge on one side and saw teeth on the other. An undoubtedly lethal weapon. The sheer amount of blood found in Duane Demke's car suggested a fatal outcome. While it was highly likely to be Duane's blood, they couldn't be sure until the DNA analysis results came back. The wait would be agonizingly long for his family and friends. In the meantime, detectives focused their attention on the elusive Robert Aubrey Maxwell. Through meticulous record searches, they uncovered a surprising but fortunate revelation. Robert had a previous arrest record for assault. This meant his DNA was cataloged in the National Criminal Registry. This was a breakthrough. Now all they had to do was wait for the DNA tests from the North-faced hat to firmly tie their number one suspect to the disappearance of Duane Demke. Anticipation hung in the air as they awaited the lab results, knowing that the presence of DNA on the hat was not guaranteed, but they were very hopeful. They didn't sit back and wait. Instead, they kept looking for Robert. They wanted to find his vehicle. It hadn't been at his apartment. It had vanished around the same time he did. Acting swiftly, they flagged the vehicle, ensuring they would be notified immediately if it resurfaced. 2 weeks later, Detective Billoway received an alert from the Vancouver Police Department. The truck had been located at Kitsilano Beach parking lot. It appeared as if Robert had driven as far west as he could. The passenger window was partially down, allowing a faint breeze to weave its way through the parked truck. Inside, the keys sat idly in the ignition, and nestled in a drink container was a brand new cell phone, its screen gleaming under the dim light. The Vancouver police couldn't believe it hadn't been stolen on the very first day it had been left. Maybe because to a potential thief, the truck looked staged, almost like a setup. It was so obvious that someone wanted it stolen that the suspects would have thought it a bait truck and refrained from taking it. Clearly, that was the intent. Robert didn't want to be found. He wanted somebody else to take that truck, to take the heat off him. He wanted someone to take it, drive it, contaminate it, fill it with any other kind of evidence or whatever one brings into a stolen truck. And now the detectives had a truckload of evidence to examine. They wanted to search for fingerprints, go through it with a fine-toothed comb, and see what evidence they could glean. Their investigation revealed that whoever had used it had wiped it down completely. The forensic team had never seen a vehicle so clean. Even between the door panels, everywhere was wiped down, as was the cell phone found inside the cab. Who was this guy? Who would think of prepping a vehicle to be stolen by thieves and to be discovered by the police? Besides the cell phone, the CSI team found only three items of note, all in the truck bed. There was a small boat trailer, a plastic fork, and a chewed piece of gum. It seemed almost as if the driver of the vehicle had tossed the gum out the window, only for it to be caught by the wind and blown back into the truck bed. Or, maybe, somebody passing by had thrown it in themselves. Still, the detective sent the fork and the gum out for DNA testing, just in case. They weren't sure what would come of it, but with the truck so clean and lacking evidence, they were looking for anything. The detectives ran the registration on the small boat trailer, expecting it to be in Robert's name, but it was registered to someone else altogether, someone living in a Vancouver suburb. Upon interviewing the registered owner, they discovered that a man matching Robert's description had purchased the jet ski from them, paying cash and offering up a cell phone as part of the payment. Ultimately, he paid them cash for the boat and only asked one question. How far will this jet ski go on a full tank of gas? Now the police wondered where he was, and did he actually escape on a jet ski? Some of the officers believed that he could vanish among the rainforests and homes located on the coast of British Columbia. There were islands covered with empty cottages that could be in easy range of a jet ski full of gas. He'd be able to hide for years if he wanted to. Other officers disagreed. They believed that Robert may have taken the jet ski to Point Roberts, Washington, which is just a small peninsula south of Vancouver, Canada. That little sliver of land is part of the United States. If he rode the jet ski there, he'd be able to get into America undetected and without having to go through U.S. Customs. This made them wonder if Robert had ties to people in America, people who would shelter him. This was a reasonable idea, except there was nothing connecting Robert to the U.S. No relatives, friends, or girlfriends as far as they could tell. It seemed like they'd hit a dead end. Just to be sure, they searched the entire shoreline of Point Roberts, but there were no jet skis floating around there. So they moved their search further north along the Canadian shoreline. They ran the jet skis' registration numbers through a national database for stolen cars and boats. Sure enough, the jet ski had been seized a few days earlier by the Delta Police Department. It had washed up next to a ferry terminal. The little piece of land where it was found was the last piece of land that stuck out into the ocean before you got to Point Roberts. So it was possible that he dumped the jet ski just north of the border and swam the rest of the way in. Or it was possible the current pulled the jet ski back towards Canada. Whichever it was, it didn't matter, because the police knew at this point he was in the U.S. and they were on the right track. Unfortunately, if Robert had snuck back into the U.S. illegally, he could be anywhere. They were stuck with no forward momentum in the case for another 6 weeks. That's when the DNA analysis came back on the plastic fork and the chewing gum that someone had thrown into the bed of the white pickup truck. The fork came back clean. There was no DNA on it. But there was DNA on the gum. The police had a sneaking suspicion it would belong to Robert. They were wrong. It came back as an unknown male. It didn't match Robert Aubrey Maxwell, and it didn't match anyone else in the national DNA database. It seemed that that lead was a dud. But maybe that North Face hat would come back with the DNA. And if it did, it could lock up the case. Everyone waited with bated breath for those results, which came 4 days later. Once again, detectives hoped it would belong to Robert. It had to be his. But it wasn't. Surprisingly, it matched the DNA of the unknown male who threw the chewing gum into the back of the truck. How could that be? This was a big problem for investigators. The whole team felt like their heads were spinning. They'd been chasing Robert Aubrey Maxwell this whole time. Who was this new guy? Was Robert innocent, or could he have had an accomplice? They had to figure out who this unknown male was. Since his DNA was tied to the case, they were almost certain he was the guy who killed Duane, but all the evidence they had gathered so far pointed towards Robert. At this point, it seemed the only answer was that two men were involved in Duane's death, except all the surveillance videos showed only one person. The videos outside the limo service and the one taken by the walker only pictured one man. What were they missing? They needed more ideas, so they brought fresh sets of eyes to the case. As they laid out the case for a group of detectives, one man, Detective Kurt Martin, looked up from his desk and said simply, "Well, how do we know that Robert Aubrey Maxwell is actually Robert Aubrey Maxwell?" That simple, yet profound statement turned the investigation on a dime. What if they'd been chasing the wrong guy all along? Or at least the wrong name? Police hadn't contacted Robert's family for good reason. Obviously, they didn't want family members to tip off Robert that they were on his tail. But now they needed to talk to someone. That someone was Robert's grandmother, the woman who raised him. She told police that she hadn't seen Robert since 2012. He left Ontario and went to Vancouver, and as far as she knew, he was living there on the streets. He had a serious drug problem and drifted from place to place. The detectives went to Vancouver to see if anyone there had contact with Robert, not necessarily as a criminal, but as a drug user. Vancouver had been familiar with him. Back in late 2012, Robert lived on the seedier side of Vancouver in an area called the East Side. Officers in that area had known him well. Being homeless and a drug user, he was dealt with by the police almost every week. He bounced from street to street and shelter to shelter. But in September of 2012, he seemingly vanished. He was no longer on the police's radar, and his grandmother never spoke with him after that time. He never showed up at another shelter. After 5 months of silence, his grandmother reported him missing. At that time, police found the last rooming house he'd been staying in. He wasn't there and hadn't been for a while, but when he was last there, he cashed a check from a company in Edmonton called Architectural Glass. Back in early 2013, after his grandmother had reported him missing, police contacted Architectural Glass and spoke with Robert. They called him to tell him that his grandmother had reported him missing and that she hadn't heard from him in a long time. She was worried and wanted to know what he was doing. He told them he was fine, living and working in Edmonton, and didn't want anything to do with his family. He decided to cut ties with them and didn't want to be considered missing anymore. He told the police he wouldn't be in touch with his family ever again, so they canceled their missing persons file. Then they called his poor grandmother to tell her that they found Robert and he's fine, but he didn't want anything to do with them anymore. That was the last time his family had heard anything from him. Fast forward to 2015, over 2 years after that awkward conversation with Grandma. The new detectives, hoping to figure out who Robert Aubrey Maxwell really was, sent Robert's grandmother his most recent driver's license photo. She looked at it and immediately said, "That's not my grandson. I've never seen this man before." Crossing T's and dotting I's, the detectives checked with police in Robert's hometown to see if they had an old booking photo from one of his drug arrests. They did, and compared the two photos, Robert's driver's license and the old booking photo. It was clear they were not the same man. Whoever the man was they were chasing, it wasn't Robert Aubrey Maxwell. In fact, the real Robert Aubrey Maxwell was probably dead, killed by someone who stole his identity. It's obvious now what police were thinking. They likely had two dead bodies and two murders to investigate. To make matters worse, the police now had to make a terrible phone call. Duane's brother Darren answered. They told him the DNA had come back, which momentarily lifted Darren's spirits, but it came crashing down when police said, "It's not who we thought it was. It's not Robert. We don't know whose it is, but we're going to figure it out." The investigative team hit reset and went back to the drawing board. They pored over past interviews and noticed that in one of Angel's interviews, remember her, Robert's ex, the one who pointed her finger at him in the first place? Well, she had mentioned that at some point Robert had been in Washington State for a while before coming to Vancouver. This gave police a great idea. They took a picture of the most recent license they had of the fake Robert and ran it through the facial recognition software at the Washington State Department of Motor Vehicles. This request was really a giant fishing expedition. They needed a name they could attach to that mystery DNA. If they had one, they could run that unknown DNA profile through a U.S. database known as CODIS. The FBI had agreed to this, but only if they had a name to compare it to first. Luckily, 3 months into the investigation of Duane's death, the homicide unit finally caught a big break. The Washington State DMV called to tell investigators that the computer had kicked several photos out of their system for them to take a look at. There were 25 photos in all, each one given a probability rating on a scale of 0 to 1, with 1 being the best match. One of the photos was a perfect match and looked one heck of a lot like the man in the video footage they had seen. That man's name was Jason Stedman. 3 months into the investigation of Duane's disappearance and presumed death, Detectives learned that the man they were chasing was wanted in two countries and had at least three different identities. Jason Stedman did time in Florida during the 90s for burglary, grand theft, and arson. He had family in Washington State, an ex-wife named Jennifer, and a young daughter. When Jennifer Stedman met Jason through a singles club, he told her that his name was Jason. Just Jason, no last name. He told Jennifer he didn't have a relationship with his parents or his family and didn't want anything to do with them. He didn't even want to share their last name, so he had it removed legally. Jennifer and Jason hit it off right away. Jennifer thought he was good-looking, a charmer, polite, kind, and courteous. He love-bombed her, waiting on her hand and foot and promising her the world. She had no idea that this charmer was a convicted felon. All she knew is that when Jason started talking about settling down, getting married, and having a family, she was all in. She had wanted to have kids for a while, so when Jason began talking about a baby, she was thrilled. He even started buying baby gear, things like a stroller, a car seat, and a crib, before the couple even got pregnant. Jennifer thought she'd found the perfect man, one who would treat her like a queen. She was 3 months pregnant when she and Jason married in Vegas on New Year's Day of 2009. Jason would take her last name, and 6 months later, their daughter was born. Jason became a middle-class dad with a wife, a baby, and a nice apartment. He had a good job as a union delivery driver. Life looked good for him, but the same can't be said for Jennifer. He was no longer treating her like royalty. Instead, he'd leave for long periods of time, hanging out with his friends, and even found himself a girlfriend. When he came home and Jennifer would confront him about what he was doing, he would slap her and get physical. By the time their daughter was 2 months old, they fought constantly, and Jason began threatening her life. He put his hands around her neck, choking her, and threatening that if she took his daughter away from him, he would kill her. Jennifer was desperate to get out of the marriage. She began contemplating how she and their daughter would leave Jason safely. Her fear kept her from moving forward. On Thanksgiving Day, less than a year after they'd been married, they sat down for dinner when suddenly all hell broke loose. Someone was pounding on their apartment door. When she looked through the peephole, all she could see was a bright light. She thought it must be the fire department. Maybe somebody set off a smoke alarm. She opened the door to find 20 FBI agents wearing bulletproof vests and pointing guns at her. They held a battering ram in their arms, prepared to knock the door down. They quickly entered the room, tearing her home apart as they separated her and Jason. In time, Jennifer would learn, to her considerable surprise, that he had been fired from his job 2 months earlier, and he hadn't taken it well. After being fired, he decided to teach his boss a lesson. It began fairly simply by flooding the bathrooms. When that didn't quench his thirst for revenge, he began mailing threatening death threats filled with white powder to his employer's headquarters with the Seattle Times. When that still wasn't enough, he began making pipe bombs and putting them in newspaper boxes. Jennifer had no idea this stuff was going on. They ended up arresting Jason and charging him with homeland terrorism. The pipe bombs had been fake, and the white powder was nothing more threatening than cornstarch, but his over-the-top scare tactics would lead to a 2-year sentence. Jennifer was able to divorce him while he was in jail. She had a chance to start over. It wasn't easy, but it was a blessing because he was removed from her life before things got worse between them. This worked for a little while, but Jason would be released on probation after serving less than a year, and as soon as he was released, he started calling Jennifer, wanting to see their daughter. He would demand unsupervised visits with her whenever he wanted, and this made Jennifer nervous. She went to the court and filed a restraining order against him, which he evaded. Every time they went to serve him, he wouldn't be there. They even tried serving the papers at college classes he had been taking, but he wasn't there when they went. A plan was made to serve the papers at Jason's next parole meeting, but he didn't show up for it. At that point, police went to his apartment to find out he'd completely moved out. He vanished. He was now considered a fugitive, so the U.S. Marshals Service started hunting him. They learned quickly that he had bought one-way bus tickets for himself and a child. It was clear to Jennifer he was trying to make good on his threats. She was terrified that he was going to kill her and take their daughter. The police took it seriously, too. A detective would meet her in the parking lot when she got to her work, walk her inside the job. Then one of the security guards where she worked would stay with her during her 8-hour shift. When she'd clock out, someone would be there to walk her from the door of her work to her car. For a while, she lived her life in terror, constantly looking over her shoulder, putting extra locks on her doors and alarms on her doors and windows in case he tried to break in. In time, Jennifer let down her guard because Jason had seemed to vanish. Nobody had any idea where he was or what he might try to do next. It was August 2012 when he left Jennifer's life. She nor the police had any idea where he was, and as far as Jennifer was concerned, it was good riddance. She hoped he'd stay gone. The police had issued an arrest warrant declaring he was a flight risk and a danger to the community, but none of them knew that Jason had already taken off to Canada, and at some point, he went to the downtown east side of Vancouver, where the real Robert Aubrey Maxwell was living in a shelter. It was from that shelter that the real Robert had called his grandmother for the last time on September 6, 2012. 6 days later, Jason, using Robert's birth certificate, applied for a government photo ID card. And just like that, both the real Robert Aubrey Maxwell and the real Jason Steadman no longer existed. Police believed that Jason killed Robert so he could assume his identity. That way, he'd be able to work and live in Alberta without any problems. He was able to get a social insurance number, a passport, and a job. The only way he could do this without fear was if the real Robert Aubrey Maxwell was dead. He started a one-man glass business, began dating Angel Shalafu, and eventually, probably, killed Dwayne Dimkew. But where was he now? Maybe he'd gone to Mexico. He could speak Spanish. Well, Jennifer had one more piece of information for the police. Jason had shown up out of the blue. He had been gone for 2 or 3 years, and when he came back, Jennifer's panic and terror came back in full force. He'd shown up at Jennifer's mother's house, asking to see his daughter. Somehow, he had known his daughter would be there. He spoke with her briefly, asking the 6-year-old if she knew who he was. When she said no, he told her that he was her dad. When Jennifer heard this, all she could think was that she couldn't get to her daughter fast enough. She drove as fast as she could, terrified that her daughter wouldn't be there by the time she got to the house. Within 5 minutes she was there, but Jason was already gone. She felt relief, but she also felt panic, worried that he was still around. She grabbed her daughter and took her to the safest place she could think of in the quickest amount of time she could. She knew she wasn't safe. Jason was out there somewhere. She called the U.S. Marshals, who scoured the town but couldn't find him anywhere. Jennifer had been afraid to go home, but didn't know where else to go. Like many times before, Jason seemed to vanish, only to reappear 3 days later in a spot no one ever expected him to be. And all the time the authorities had been chasing him, they hadn't been able to catch him. They thought he was probably south of the border and out of their jurisdictions. But a few days later, investigators would get a call from the U.S. Marshals in Seattle. Jason Steadman had turned himself in. Thinking himself smarter than everyone, Jason had hatched a plan. He thought he could pull off his greatest escape yet by going back to prison. He knew a warrant had been issued for his arrest as Jason Steadman from when he sent the letters and made the fake pipe bombs. If he gave himself up and served a few months on his sentence, he'd be in the clear, and he'd be able to reassume his identity as Jason Steadman, rendering Robert Aubrey Maxwell gone for good. He had no idea that the police in Canada had figured out who he was. It wasn't until he was back in court for his resentencing that Jason learned his plan wasn't such a good one after all. In court, a U.S. Marshal stood up, telling the judge that Jason was wanted in Canada on first-degree murder charges. Jason's reaction was a wide-eyed look, followed by putting his head down on the table and shaking his head slowly. That's when he realized the police knew everything and that he was wanted for murder. It would have been satisfying to watch. Jason had thought things through carefully and done things purposefully, but he was done in by his own mistakes. He thought that if he left little pieces of evidence behind, like the ball cap, it would solidify everyone thinking that Robert had murdered Duane. Then Jason could go back to being his old self in Washington State without anyone being the wiser. It might have worked, except that, as luck would have it, Robert Aubrey Maxwell's DNA was in the databank. God bless DNA, which was Jason's undoing. 5 months after he was arrested, the snow began melting on the vast prairies between Calgary and Edmonton. A farmer was out walking his land with his dog when the dog began digging at something in a roadside ditch. It was human skeletal remains. Those remains belonged to Duane Demke. If Duane's family and friends had any hope that he was alive, those hopes were vanquished. In September of 2016, Jason was turned over to Canadian authorities. He clammed up, letting his lawyers do all the talking. When asked why his DNA was on that North Face ball cap at the same location where Duane was last seen alive, Jason had no answer. So detectives switched course and started a line of questioning about Robert Maxwell, the real one. They wanted to know what happened to him, but again, Jason sat frozen, refusing to answer any questions put to him. Detectives had to dig deep for every scrap of information. They found emails between Jason and his brother talking about Jason living under a fake ID. He had told his brother that he bought one on the dark web. When they asked Jason's brother if he had any idea where Jason might have hidden Robert's body, he suggested that maybe it was in the sewers, because Jason seemed to like sewers. So far, Robert's body has never been found. Police think it's likely he was thrown in a dumpster and the body made its way to a landfill. It probably won't ever be found. To this day, investigators haven't been able to charge Stedman or anyone else for the presumed murder of Robert Aubrey Maxwell. As for the murder of Duane Demke, Jason pled not guilty, although prosecutors had all the DNA and video evidence saying that he did. He hid in the dumpster outside of Revolution Limousine, and with a Gerber knife, when Duane left work and approached his car, Jason stabbed him to death. He took the car with Duane in it, drove to the gravel dirt road where he dumped Duane into the ditch, then drove the car down to Calgary where he set it on fire. Later, he made his way back to Edmonton on the train. The motive, though, was harder to prove. Not that it had to be proven, but we all wanted to know why. At the trial, prosecutors were stuck trying to explain to the jury the inexplicable. There was no satisfactory explanation. But investigators think the motive was one of the oldest known to mankind. They think that Angel had broken up with Jason, and it was such a bruise to his ego that he looked for someone to blame. In Jason's narcissistic way, he blamed Duane for the failure of his relationship with Angel and set his sights on killing the man. As the trial came to a close, Jason Stedman, who remained emotionless, was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years. A 3-year sentence for arson would run concurrently, and he would be handed a lifetime weapons ban. He was 44 when he was sentenced and will be an old man when he gets out, if he lives that long. He separated himself from everyone. It's likely there will be no one to remember him, whether he gets out or not. This isn't true for his victims, who live on in the loving memories of their friends and families. Memories of great conversations, or maybe the way Duane's face lit up when he spoke of his beloved scuba trips.
Thanks so much for listening. As always, if you'd like to see pictures to go with this episode, there are links to Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon in the episode description. Come check out the socials. If you'd like to listen without the ads, join Patreon at any level to get the episodes early and ad-free. A huge thanks to everybody who shares this podcast with friends on social media and to those who take the time to give it a nice rating and review. I truly appreciate your support and wish you all fair winds, following seas, and safe travels of all kinds.